KNW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. We don't know yet if Hurricane Beryl is going to reach the U.S., but we do know it's big.
It is still way too early to determine if there will be any impact to the United States, but anyone along the Gulf Coast is going to have to watch this extremely closely and monitor all the forecasts, especially as we head into next weekend.
ABC meteorologist Dan Amarante, the hurricane has grown fast to a Category 4 in the Caribbean. 22 Minnesota counties approved for federal disaster declaration over the weekend due to severe flooding over the last 2 weeks. The Biden campaign doing damage control, trying to stop the bleeding after the president's debate performance, and so far insisting they are full steam ahead. At a fundraiser last night, the president telling donors, "I understand the concern. I didn't have a great night, but I'm going to be fighting harder." Millions of Americans looking for a getaway this 4th of July holiday coming up. The TSA expecting record numbers, with more than 32 million passing through security checkpoints between June 27th and July 8th. This is ABC News. Police are trying to figure out the motive for a mass shooting in a residential area of a small Nebraska town on Friday. ABC's Chuck Sievertson.
Police say shots from one house hit seven people at the house across the street in Crete, Nebraska, including four children, 3 to 10 years old. When officers went to confront the shooter, says Colonel John Bolduc, Nebraska State Patrol, they found
Billy Booth, age 74. Investigators located a shotgun near the deceased person.
Apparently self-inflicted, he says. Victims say recently Booth flipped them off and told them to speak English and go back where they came from. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Polling stations closing in France in the snap legislative elections called by President Macron after his party's dismal showing in EU elections earlier this month. Marine Le Pen's far-right national rally is leading with 34% of the vote. An exit poll shows the left-wing alliance, the NFP, at just over 28%. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Do you know or work with kids who have special health care needs? Help them live their best lives. Contact Wisconsin Wayfinder Children's Resource Network. Our specialists will connect you with services in your area. Wisconsin Wayfinder is free and confidential. Call 877-947-2929 or visit dhs.wi.gov/WISCWAY. Connect today. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot.
Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was, when they moved the camera. Whenever it's like the red alert. The,
right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like.
Right. Lean left. Great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.fm.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Wildlife advocates are filing another legal challenge to Wisconsin's wolf management plan. Mike Moan reports.
A coalition announced the appeal this week, and it centers on how the management plan came together under the state DNR. A judge dismissed the original lawsuit earlier this spring. It accused an agency panel of breaking the rules for how it interacted with special interest groups tied to hunting. Melissa Smith, with Friends of the Wisconsin Wolf and Wildlife, says by favoring certain voices, other wildlife groups are left behind.
It's quite egregious that the citizens of Wisconsin do not have any legal standing to challenge the rules in any decisions that's wildlife related.
The coalition says the judge's decision conflicts with principles under the public trust doctrine. The Department of Natural Resources says it cannot respond to pending litigation. This legal activity comes a few months after federal officials opted to keep the gray wolf on the endangered species list. State law requires a wolf hunt if the animal is delisted from federal protections, but the new management plan doesn't include a goal with specific numbers. Instead, the plan focuses on sustainability. Meanwhile, Smith says she wants state rules to be consistent.
If you look at the deer plan, our Wisconsin deer plan, it states plain as day that deer are held in the public trust. So it seems that it's pretty inconsistent when they decide something is held in the public trust and when something is not.
Hunting and farming groups contend the gray wolf population has grown too large, putting livestock at risk. But conservationists say these concerns are often overstated and that management efforts need to be rooted in science. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see plentiful sunshine today with highs in the lower 70s, light winds. Overnight, mostly clear skies will drop to the lower 50s. On Monday, once again, another comfortable day, sunshine and lower 70s. Showers late Monday night, currently 71 degrees.
Maggie Dawn.
I'm calling it now before the opinion actually drops. On Monday, the Supreme Court is going to decide that in some situations, American presidents are kings. There's no better place to hear the breakdown.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and we are at the top of our second hour in this very special edition of Amicus, a law review, brought to you through the auspices of the leadership and management of Civic Media to review, to analyze, to discuss some of these major decisions issued by the United States Supreme Court just this past week. Now talking about a major corruption case coming out of our own circuit right here in the Seventh Circuit, United States Court of Appeals, indicating already has to do with a former mayor of Portage, Indiana. His name is James Snyder. It's a city of about 38,000 people near Lake Michigan. Probably many of you have been there, even driven through it. He was the mayor in 2013. At that time, the city awarded two contracts for a garbage truck company. The name of that company is the Great Lakes Peterbilt Company. And Portage brought five garbage trucks for about $1.1 million. Those are the facts of the case. Now, here's where the disagreement comes in about what happens next. In 2014, after that process, that contracting process was pretty much completed, the company cut Mayor Snyder a check for $13,000. And he maintains that those were consulting services, that that's the reason why the company gave him that money. Not surprisingly, the FBI, federal prosecutors, have a different view of all this. They said the bidding process that was involved in reaching that result had been manipulated to ensure that this particular company prevailed in that process. And the investigators, the federal government coming in, said the money was a gratuity. This is important. A gratuity for the garbage truck contracts. Mr. Snyder said it was a payment for his consulting services as a contractor for Peterbilt. Again, not especially intuitive, and yes, indeed, that's the reason why this particular opinion, having a lot of people scratching their heads about the difference between bribery and gratuity payments. Jury convicted the former mayor, Mr. Snyder, of accepting an illegal gratuity, and a federal judge sends him to more than 1 year in prison. All this happening again in the district court, the Northern District of Indiana. On appeal to the Court of Appeals in Chicago, the Seventh Circuit, the defendant, Mr. Snyder, argued that the federal statute criminalized only bribes and not after-the-fact gratuities, things that happen after this particular conduct. The Federal Appeals Court then in Chicago affirmed that conviction, rejecting his position on this, interpreting Section 666. And based upon that, Mr. Snyder asked the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, to determine whether or not the lower court, the Court of Appeals, our circuit court, had gotten it right. And in the end, the United States Supreme Court said the Supreme Court was wrong about this. Went on to say the majority explained that the law typically makes a distinction between bribes, payments that are made or agreed to before a government action to influence the outcome, distinctions between that and gratuities, payments made after a government action to reward or even to thank that public official. And although the majority notes that bribes are frowned upon as inherently corrupt, nobody likes bribery, they say, federal, state, and local governments have treated gratuities with more nuance, as they have said. And so in this particular case, the Supreme Court limits the sweep of this anti-corruption law, distinguishing after-the-fact rewards from before-the-fact bribes. In its reasoning, the conservative majority said it relied on statutory history and the text of the statute itself, among other factors in all of this, to find that this particular federal statute focused on bribes and not gratuities. Let's talk more about exactly what this is all about. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, writing for a 6-3 majority, said that the question is whether the federal law makes it a crime for state and local officials to accept gratuities after the fact. And he says the answer is no. He says that gifts to officials were often already regulated by state and local governments. The federal law, he wrote, does not supplement those state and local rules by subjecting 19 million state and local officials to up to 10 years in federal prison for accepting even commonplace gratuities. In other words, he's looking at the ways in which the state laws are applied and the federal laws are applied and finding that the federal law is more narrow in its application. Rather, he wrote, the law leaves it to state and local governments to regulate gratuities to state and local officials. And he went on to say that to uphold the prosecutor's interpretation of the law would significantly infringe upon bedrock federalism principles. All that written by Justice Kavanaugh on behalf of the majority. The federal law, he added, lacked clear guidance for local officials to follow, leaving them to try to discern what actions amount to a violation. He cited examples, for example, in his opinion, nodding to the case's origins in Indiana. Here's what he said. He said, could students take their college professor out to Chipotle for an end-of-term celebration? And if so, would it somehow become criminal to take the professor for a steak dinner or treat her to a Hoosiers game? All that in the majority opinion. He went on to say that while American law generally treats bribes as inherently corrupt and unlawful, gratuities, those are another matter, he writes. Some can be problematic, where others can be commonplace and might be innocuous. He listed some examples. He said a family tipping their mail carrier, parents sending a gift basket to thank their child's teacher at the end of the school year, a college dean, for example, giving a sweatshirt to a city council member who speaks an event. Those particular examples, he writes, they all suggest that gratuities, this is his specific language, gratuities after the official act are not the same as bribes before the official act. And he adds once again in making this distinction that unlike gratuities, bribes can corrupt the official act, meaning that the official takes the act for private gain, not for public good. Lots of definitional language going on there. A concurring opinion from Neil Gorsuch. He writes the decision reflected an age-old understanding that when, as he said, any fair reader of the statute would be left with a reasonable doubt as to whether the law applied to the defendant's actions, the court, the Supreme Court here, has to err on the side of the person charged with the crime. And the court, indeed, in recent years, has narrowed a number of these anti-corruption laws. It threw out, for example, true fraud convictions involving accusations of bid rigging. You may remember this, illicit payments during the administration of Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York a number of years ago. 2020, you may recall this well. The court unanimously overturned the convictions of two defendants in that so-called Bridgegate scandal. Remember that? In which the associates of Governor Chris Christie at the time in New Jersey closed access lanes to the George Washington Bridge, supposedly to punish one of the political opponents in that case. That was an abuse of power, the court ruled, but not a federal crime. And again, doing the same kind of thing here, making distinction between what is criminal and what is not. And beyond that, the court in 2016 unanimously overturned the conviction of Bob McDonnell. He's a former governor of Virginia. He had accepted luxury products, loans, and vacations from a business executive. And so, again, many examples here
of what the court will and will not view as acceptable under this particular statute. Now, that's all in the majority opinion. That's all in the agreement about the interpretation of this case in Snyder. The decision, of course, reflected also another sharp division inside the court. You have Ketanji Brown Jackson and Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, again, right down ideological lines here, vehemently dissenting. And they go on to say that the interpretation given by the court here is simply wrong. Officials who use their public positions for private gain threaten the integrity of our most important institutions. That written by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. She goes on to say, greed makes governments at every level less responsive, less efficient, and less trustworthy from the perspective of the communities they served. And in what appears to me to be something of a dig, a kind of an attack at the court's other side that resolving this case in the other direction, Justice Jackson added the defendant in this case offered an absurd and atextual reading of the statute that she said only today's court could love. Only today's court could love what this particular defendant is selling. She plainly is not at all convinced by what the majority says in its particular case. Now, the other reason why this case is getting a lot of attention, in addition to being kind of a local case from here in the Seventh Circuit going up to the Supreme Court telling the Seventh Circuit that they're wrong in their interpretation, is because this whole issue of gratuities and things that are received by officials in the public domain also raise the same kinds of concerns that we have seen recently inside the Supreme Court itself. We know that there's been a lot of discussion about these kinds of things, a lot of revelations by entities like ProPublica and others in the national media that, for example, Justice Clarence Thomas had failed to reveal some luxury travel and other gifts from a friend of his, this Texas billionaire, a fellow named Arlen Crow, revelations about other justices, including Sam Alito, and prompting this whole focus on whether there should be an ethics code before the Supreme Court. This particular case in which a majority of the Supreme Court says, gratuities, those are okay. Bribery, out-and-out bribery, that is different. It's also prompting a lot of people to say, gee, is this a little bit too close to home? Are the Supreme Court justices in the majority, unlike those in the minority, are they in fact going down this road because of their own concerns about internal criticism in the public domain? No one indicating here that there is criminal conduct by members of the Supreme Court, but this entire issue about gifts, receipts of gratuities, things given to you in the public sector, from the public sector, in the public sector, also looming large inside this decision in Snyder versus United States, decided on June 26, 2024. Justices Kavanaugh, Roberts, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Barrett all deciding in favor of the defendant. And again, indicating that the statute itself misinterpreted by the Seventh Circuit, misinterpreted by the prosecutors there, Jackson, Sotomayor, and Kagan all saying just the opposite. That did not happen here. Another important case, understanding statutory interpretation coming out of our Supreme Court just this past term. When we return with more discussion of the Supreme Court, we're going to talk about homelessness in America, Supreme Court wrestling with that, and also opioids, another big issue for the Supreme Court on its docket, and therefore on the docket also of this Amicus A Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
If you're looking for a new couch, you could cut down on expenses by bundling your car and renter's insurance with Progressive. Because you know you've had this couch for too long. Sure, you've had good times together, but a ripped up cushion is not a fond memory. It's a sign. Notice how other people have couches with two armrests? Now that's living, right? No, it's just normal. So bundle your renters and car insurance with Progressive and put the savings toward a new couch. Please. It's time. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company coverage provided in service by affiliates and third-party insurers. Not available in all states.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in a quick podcast form? Search no more. Find it now at WGBW.FM. Your news just for the Green Bay area. I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on the talk of Green Bay, 97.9 FM and 1590 AM WGBW. And on the Civic Media app. This is the talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. We are continuing our discussion on this special edition of our broadcast of all things Supreme Court, all things related to decisions issued by the nine members of our highest court in our land, the United States Supreme Court, coming out here in June of 2024. A couple of final opinions coming out tomorrow on July 1, probably the last day of decisions. A couple of big things happening tomorrow in social media, also having to do with immunity, as you know well. In this special Sunday afternoon broadcast of our show, talking about this Fisher case, the case in which the Supreme Court says that the government had misinterpreted, misunderstood the mechanisms for charging at least Mr. Fisher and arguably others under the federal code. Another case involving Snyder, likewise coming to the same result, different statute, different criminal provision, also indicating that the Seventh Circuit and the lower court prosecutors in that venue had misunderstood a corruption statute there. Supreme Court, again, deciding, as John Roberts has said in this other matter, Loper Bright Enterprises, indicating once again that it is exclusively the power and the prerogative of the Supreme Court to tell us what the law is. And indeed, that is what they are doing in these cases. Also then talking about this abortion case in which the Supreme Court decides that it had basically made a mistake in deciding the case or bringing the case on as soon as it did, reserving perhaps for another day whether or not the particular Idaho statute that does a virtual ban on abortions is in fact superseded by a federal law. All of those things coming out of the Supreme Court just this past week. We've got at least two more cases also to discuss on this Sunday afternoon. Thank you so much for joining me in our continuing review of all things Supreme Court. Let us talk about opioids. Let's talk about the reason why the Supreme Court is now weighing in on an opioid case resolution. How do we get into this? Let's go back and do a little bit of history about the opioid crisis and epidemic in America. 1999 to about 2019, somewhere around 250,000 people, 250,000 people in our country died from prescription-related opioids. A lot of this coming from the opinion itself in this case, also from extraneous information. That, according to the Supreme Court, and probably according to the memorandums and pleadings filed with the Supreme Court, in certain reliance upon the statistics that are out there, all of that, the impact on the health, the condition, the life, the livelihood of Americans, resulting in a cost to the country of about $53 billion, with a B, $53 billion to $72 billion annually. And in the majority opinion, which we will get to, again, written by Justice Gorsuch, Purdue, that is the principal target of this particular case and the bankruptcy matter, the civil matter presented here, Purdue sits at the center of these events. Indeed, it does. How does this come about? Well, in the mid-1990s, Purdue Pharma, P-U-R-D-U-E, Pharma, began marketing probably what you recall well as OxyContin. Remember this drug? You probably recall it well from news stories. Maybe even your own family has been affected by what happened in the midst of this opioid crisis. And although that kind of drug was traditionally used in some limited cases, the company claimed that it had basically created a new formula, a new way of designing this that lowered the risk of opioid addiction.
And it opened the drug to a much wider array of patients. A lot of this, again, the public domain, a lot of this in allegations brought by claimants, families, others affected by what this particular company did, and in particular, the Sackler family, right? You recall this as well. This is the family that basically the chief operating officers and the movers and shakers behind Purdue Pharma. The drug success, the success of OxyContin, this opioid drug, basically catapulted, if you will, the Sacklers into the position where they're among the wealthiest of Americans out there. An estimated worth in the wake of their doing this, about $14 billion, again, with the B dollars. All of this relevant to what comes up as follows here. It established them, plainly, as a major player in American economics, also major donors. You know this well, too, to museums and medical schools and academic institutions as this played out. But by about 2007, as it became clearer and clearer to the healthcare industry and to Americans across the country, the number of overdose deaths mounted from opioids. This becomes clearer and clearer beginning about 2007. And three of Purdue's top executives at that time are pleading guilty to federal criminal charges, again, unrelated to this particular bankruptcy case, but related factually to it. They plead guilty to federal criminal charges, and the company is also fined more than $600 million for misleading the regulators and doctors and patients about what they had said previously, as I just recited, the drug's potential for abuse limiting the sense to which this particular drug does in fact pose a risk of serious addiction. So the first opioid lawsuits were filed against Purdue Pharma about 2014 or so, and they unleashed a real flood. It can only be described as a flood of litigation and further intensified the scrutiny on the Sacklers and Purdue Pharma on their role in creating this opioid crisis in America. And so finally, in the wake of all that, this huge amounts of money, the fines imposed, and the other exposure out there potentially by the Sacklers and the Purdue family, 2019, Purdue Pharma files for bankruptcy restructuring. It's called Chapter 11. It is routinely accessible to companies who are seeking restructuring, not complete dismantlement, but restructuring. And it ultimately paused all of these lawsuits against the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma in particular. And the numbers, according to most reporting at the time, about 400 of the claims against the family. That decision by the bankruptcy court was controversial from the start. And under a deal that was approved by a bankruptcy judge in 2021, in the midst of all of this, all of these claims, the Sacklers now inside the bankruptcy court, Purdue Pharma is dissolved. And as a part of this overall approach, the company would give billions of dollars to the opioid crisis to try to affect it, putting an end to thousands of related claims. That was the agreement. If indeed they give these monies to address the opioid crisis in other ways, all these claims are extinguished. The Sacklers themselves, under this plan in the bankruptcy court, would be guaranteed protection from civil liability. And that's one of the major controversial aspects of this bankruptcy plan. The Sacklers also proposed to end all the lawsuits without the consent of the opioid victims who brought them. And that, too, a key element to all this. And according to Justice Gorsuch, again, you can see where this is going, very critical of all this. He explains that release would not just prevent suits against the company's officers and directors, but would run in favor of hundreds, if not thousands, of Sackler family members and entities under their control. As we continue to examine what exactly happened here, the bankruptcy court will address what the Supreme Court did in this case, how it handled this Sackler-Purdue Pharma matter, and what it said about the power of the bankruptcy court to do what it did. All of that coming up here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. We don't know yet if Hurricane Beryl is going to reach the U.S., but we do know it's big.
It is still way too early to determine if there will be any impact to the United States, but anyone along the Gulf Coast is going to have to watch this extremely closely and monitor all the forecasts, especially as we head into next weekend.
ABC meteorologist Dan Amarante, the hurricane has grown fast to a Category 4 in the Caribbean. 22 Minnesota counties approved for federal disaster declaration over the weekend due to severe flooding over the last 2 weeks. The Biden campaign doing damage control, trying to stop the bleeding after the president's debate performance, and so far insisting they are full steam ahead. At a fundraiser last night, the president telling donors, "I understand the concern. I didn't have a great night, but I'm going to be fighting harder." Millions of Americans looking for a getaway this 4th of July holiday coming up. The TSA expecting record numbers, with more than 32 million passing through security checkpoints between June 27th and July 8th. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Brewers lose to the Cubs. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers losing before a sellout at American Family Field, nearly half of them Cubs fans, as Chicago pulled off a 5-3 victory Saturday. The Cubs jumped out to an early lead with a single, then a two-run homer by Chicago's Michael Busch on just the first two pitches of the game. Brewers starter Tobias Myers.
I think a lot of it's just baseball. They were aggressive today. They know what I've been doing the last couple weeks is attacking with the four-seam, so I think they did a pretty good job of coming out and putting some good swings on some fastballs.
The crew battled back to a 3-3 tie until reliever Yoel Piamps gave up a walk and a home run to Ian Happ in the eighth. Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
You're in the major leagues and you're pitching at that time in the game. Walks are not a possibility. I mean, it's just not part of it. If you look at our pitching staff, a lot of our success, and it's been great this year, of not giving up free bases. The home run is the home run.
That's Pat Murphy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see plentiful sunshine today with highs in the lower 70s, light winds. Overnight, mostly clear skies will drop to the lower 50s. On Monday, once again, another comfortable day, sunshine and lower 70s. Showers late Monday night, currently 71 degrees.
It's 2024 and Worthington, Minnesota continues to shine. We've expanded so many things. It's a time of growth. We've expanded recreation activities with our indoor ice arena, our indoor turf rec center and playground, and our outdoor water park, Waterworld, is ready for another season. Our schools have expanded and so has our industry. We're continuing to expand our population also, with lots ready to build on Glenwood Heights. So let's grow together in Worthington, Minnesota. It's worth a look.
At Fleet Farm, we know every sunny day doesn't begin and end with us. But if it did, we've got you covered. Everyday fishing gear from Rapala, Berkeley, and Minn Kota. Everyday grilling goods from Weber, Kingsford, and Blackstone. Everyday camping gear from Coleman, Yeti, and Eureka. Whatever makes your day, we're right there with you. At Fleet Farm, we've got everything you need for everyday life.
It's official. Governor Tony Evers proclaims this June as Pride Month in Wisconsin. But did you know the state has a long history of activism alongside LGBTQ communities and allies? The Civic Media Radio Network supports the impact and celebrations and is sharing thoughtful stories all month long.
Photographs, paperwork, and stories about the LGBTQ plus movement in our state now being collected for the Wisconsin First Archive Project. It's a new effort to preserve and celebrate the history and national legacy of Wisconsin as the first state to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. Organizers say providing this history in one place will improve awareness and keep these memories alive. The effort is being led by Our Lives Media, a Madison-based nonprofit, which will offer a free online archive. It's a proud moment during this Pride Month to remember the fight for equal rights includes equality for all. I'm Terry Barr.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
Coming up on Monday, Johnny's off, so Frank Hermans joins me on the show. Brittany Merlot will have our weather forecast for the week, and we'll get a final report from Peter and Tracy Flukey about their tandem bike trip to New York City.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday mornings 6 till 9.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Here on Amicus, a law review, we are continuing in this very special edition of our broadcast to talk about the United States Bankruptcy Court and what it did and did not do in connection with the opioid crisis, talking in great detail about not only the nature of the crisis, but what the nature of the plan was to resolve all of this inside the bankruptcy court, which is, of course, an entity of the federal courts that established by the Constitution of the United States of America that bankruptcy is a matter exclusively to the federal courts in our system. And noting along the way the impact of the resolution of all these claims against Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family in particular, and the impact upon the families affected by the opioid crisis itself. Under this particular deal, again, Purdue Pharma would become what's called a public benefit company. And that means that its mission would be focused principally upon opioid education and abatement. In other words, the company no longer exists, but its entity, its basic purpose, its mission would be to try to address the very problem that it created in the first place. The company, with the help of the Sackler family's own contributions to this process, offered some individual victims payments from a base amount of somewhere around $3,500, a ceiling on all of these individual payments of about $48,000. Again, all of this a part of the plan. The most of the creditors inside this plan who voted on their proposed plan supported going forward with all this. Fewer than 20% of the eligible creditors participated, and thousands of opioid victims voted against the plan. And many pleaded with the bankruptcy court not to wipe out their claims against the Sacklers without their specific consent, without their approval. So again, you've got a resolution here with which not everyone, great majorities of people involved in this matter, do not agree. A federal district court judge looking at this bankruptcy plan, again, the district court, different from the bankruptcy court, even though they're all federal courts, a federal district court looking at this bankruptcy plan, again, you can appeal from a bankruptcy court to the federal district court. He overturns the deal, says no, the plan basically erred in giving these kinds of protections to members of the Sackler family. Can't do this. Bankruptcy court cannot engage in this kind of very expansive disposition of what are very serious claims, especially in the midst of the thousands of victim families who object to what's going on here. The Sacklers then come back and they increase their offer to about $1.73 billion, again with a B, $1.73 billion. And many of the parties who had previously objected to this now signed on to it and thought, I can perhaps get some benefit out from under this plan, and they agree not to object to it going forward. And Purdue Pharma, in particular, said, as this matter then the reviewed comes up from the district court and eventually reaches the Supreme Court, maintained that a ruling against it would cause some very significant damage. That's what they tell the courts. If the court rejected this deal, it said, it would harm victims and needlessly delay the distribution of billions of dollars to abate the opioid crisis. And so in August of last year, the justices of the Supreme Court paused the settlement and agreed to hear the case. They granted certiorari. Why? Because of the great majority of the complaints about it, the atypical nature of what the bankruptcy court has done, and also the need not only to define what the bankruptcy court can and cannot do, but provides some sense of going forward here in the interest of moving this toward resolution, question whether or not the resolution does in fact do that, and the dissent from what the Supreme Court identifying that. So what happens here? The United States Supreme Court, in the wake of all that history, not only with respect to the opioid crisis, but also how it's handled in the bankruptcy court, the overturning of this decision by the district court, said members of the Sackler family cannot be shielded from this kind of liability for civil claims
related to the epidemic. Cannot do this. And therefore put in jeopardy, if you will, this entire bankruptcy plan that would have offered some protection in exchange for channeling these billions of dollars from the Sacklers toward addressing this crisis. 5-4 decision. Justices found that the deal, which again, the result of lots of negotiation over the years, it includes various states, it includes tribal entities, local governments, again, many individuals, many, many people involved in all this, had broken it, violated a basic tenet of bankruptcy law by shielding, by preventing members of the Sackler family from these lawsuits without the consent of those who might otherwise sue, and basically acknowledging that these folks had a right to have their claims adjudicated. The plan, again, under Purdue Pharma's approach and approved by the bankruptcy court, would have made this prescription painkiller, the maker of this painkiller, are responsible to pay off those claims, but would also have provided these broad protections to the Sackler family. And the control of that company, of course, remains in them. And that is the focus of what happened up to the time that the Supreme Court resolves all this. Supreme Court saying, no, can't do this. Neil Gorsuch, again, writing for the majority Supreme Court here, says, the Sacklers have not filed for bankruptcy and have not placed virtually all of their assets on the table for distribution to creditors, yet they seek what essentially amounts to a discharge. He writes that, again, he's joined by Justices Clarence Thomas, Sam Alito, Amy Coney Barrett, and yes, Ketanji Brown Jackson as well. He acknowledges that by doing this, saying that because of the problems in this plan, the fact that the Sacklers themselves have not been subject to bankruptcy, while he acknowledges that all this decision leaves the plan in limbo, he said the threat of these future lawsuits from opioid victims in the states and these government entities, these others, might compel the Sacklers to negotiate consensual releases on terms more favorable to opioid victims. In other words, even though we are finding right now that this plan cannot go ahead, maybe, just maybe, this will address some of the concerns of some of those who are not a part of this resolution, who have these legitimate claims, who've otherwise objected to this at the lower court level. Justice Gorsuch writes this. He says, if the past is prologue, then there may be a better deal on the horizon. And he talks in particular about something else we should chat about, which is the U.S. Trustee's Office has a special role in this entire process, as they often do in claims of this sort. In a strongly worded dissent, of course, some of the other justices take this on and talk about the ways in which the challenges raised by the trustee's office are adjudicated by the United States Supreme Court. Very strongly worded dissent. Brett Kavanaugh, joined in this case by Chief Justice John Roberts, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, again, an interesting combination of Supreme Court justices, warn of the consequences for the tens of thousands of families seeking compensation. They warn about the impact of what the Supreme Court is doing now in stopping this plan from going forward. The decision, they say, these are their words, is wrong on the law and devastating for more than 100,000 opioid victims and their families. He also adds that rejecting the provision simply inflicts still more injury on the opioid victims. A very different perspective from the majority on this. The U.S. Trustee's Office, again, had challenged this deal, and plainly the dissent here falling on the opposite side, saying that, no, the deal should go ahead because of the consequences of not proceeding and the delay that will come from all of this. Members of the Sackler family, in the wake of all this, have expressed some public interest in hoping that they will reach another settlement of this case. They were concerned that there may be some costly and chaotic legal proceedings yet ahead. Those words in courtrooms across the country, but remain committed, apparently, to some resolution of this. Again, the majority in this particular case, fascinating case in terms of what the bankruptcy court can and cannot do, and in particular, resolving, certainly imperfectly and incompletely, this terrible crisis in America, focusing on the method that the Sackler family had used to insulate themselves from these opioid-related lawsuits. And they found in particular that a third party under the bankruptcy rules cannot use the bankruptcy system itself, the basic trappings of the court, to shield themselves, as the Sacklers have apparently done, from litigation and binding other people who are involved in the same kinds of claims without their consent. The bankruptcy system, Justice Gorsuch wrote, although it's complex, it's not at all intuitive, rests on a simple bargain, as he said, allowing a party in debt to release itself from its financial obligations if the debtor proceeds with honesty and places virtually all of its assets on the table for its creditors. Purdue Pharma filed for bankruptcy protection after this opioid crisis. The Sacklers had not. That seized upon by the majority here to find this plan cannot go ahead. Instead, the Sacklers asking the court overseeing Purdue's bankruptcy for an order extinguishing the vast number of existing and potential claims against them. That approach, the majority said, writing Justice Gorsuch on behalf of that majority, allowed the Sacklers to win relief without securing the consent of those affected or placing anything approaching their total assets on the table for their creditors. Unfair, basically, he says. And for that reason, this major bankruptcy deal that would have brought this to some resolution now in limbo, as the dissenters indicate. We'll see what happens down the road. Plenty of merits on both sides of this particular dispute, but a significant issue in the history of America, not only in connection with the bankruptcy court and what happened here, but as we think again, continue to suffer in the wake of the opioid crisis in America, a 5-4 decision in this case, not permitting the bankruptcy plan to go forward. Brett Kavanaugh, John Roberts, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan saying there are greater interests here, and those are the interests of the opioid affected families. We should go ahead and try to accomplish something good here. That will not happen, at least not in the immediate future. Again, a split of the Supreme Court, 5-4, not down ideological lines. Once again, underscoring what I've often said, which is the notion that you can predict with absolute certainty based upon which justices are on which side of an ideological line. Simply not true here, as you get some in both directions, both opposing and supporting this particular plan. Let's talk now about yet another issue important to America and out there in our general understanding about how we engage with other people, and particular the homeless populations, not just in the state of Oregon, but around the country, including right here in the state of Wisconsin. Lots of what's about we're about to discuss has implications for localities throughout our nation. The Supreme Court on Friday upholding an Oregon city's laws that were aimed at preventing homeless residents from sleeping outdoors, and saying that they did not, those particular ordinances and the enforcement of them, did not violate the Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. And yes, if you're identifying that language, you know that that comes from the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. We've got a claim by homeless populations, and in particular, a small number of the homeless residents in this place, this small city in Oregon, known as Grants Pass, Oregon, claiming that the Eighth Amendment is violated by virtue of the local ordinance enforcement that requires that they not be sleeping outdoors and doing other things when they do not have other places to go. And that's a very critical portion of understanding what the Supreme Court did in this case involving Grants Pass, Oregon. A rule of 6-3 split. Again, this one on ideological lines. Justice Neil Gorsuch, again, writing the majority and indicating that the municipality here can indeed enforce these ordinances and can indeed require that members, populations of homeless people there in Grants Pass and presumably other places around the nation can in fact be penalized for sleeping and camping in these public places, sidewalks, streets, and parks. more on this important homeless case as Amicus, a Law Review, continues in this special edition.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
Look up cheese curds. You'll find this basic definition: wet pieces of curdled milk.
Huh?
Well, it should also include the word delicious. As we continue to celebrate June Dairy Month, do you know how much milk is needed to make 1 pound of cheese curds? 16 ounces, 64 ounces, or 160 ounces, 10 pounds of milk? The answer coming up.
It actually is a sound of freshness.
Rachel Kerr is talking about squeaky curds. She's with the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and a bit of a cheese nerd.
Those elastic protein strands rub against the enamel of your teeth and create that characteristic sound.
The squeak turns stretchy when battered and deep fried. Some believe the idea to fry globs of cheese happened by accident. I consider it a happy accident. Okay, did you guess? It takes 10 pounds of milk, which is a big gallon jug plus a little bit more, to make 1 pound of squeaky cheese curds. Call me your curd girl for this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name, Jim Santel. This is our final segment in a special two-hour program this afternoon, also a part of a special two-day presentation through the auspices of Civic Media on all things Supreme Court related, talking about the last of these 10 major cases decided by the Supreme Court just this past week, anticipating two more major cases tomorrow, talking about homelessness. Dispute arises again from this place called Grants Pass, a town of about 40,000 people in southern Oregon. Residents there, as do residents in other municipalities, other places around our nation, complaining about people sleeping in alleyways and property damage downtown. Other problems that the residents of Grants Pass identify to their city leaders. And the city leaders respond by enforcing a series of local ordinances that are on the books. They ban sleeping in public places. Significantly, the town has no homeless shelters, aside by one that's apparently run by a religious organization that required, among other things, attendance at Christian services. Now, a group of homeless residents, as I indicated before, sue the city, and they challenge these ordinances on the very interesting theory, the notion that these local laws essentially criminalize homelessness. And the laws, although there are civil penalties that are imposed upon them, could eventually lead to jail time, is what they say. And as a result of that, the enforcement of these ordinances run afoul of the Eighth Amendment, the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. A federal judge temporarily sides with those homeless plaintiffs and finds that the city had no shelter that met the requirements of a prior decision in 2018 that was also had to do with the ways in which municipalities can and cannot deal with homeless populations. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit. Again, once again, Oregon, a part of the Ninth Circuit, just like we're a part of the Seventh Circuit. There, Oregon goes up to the Ninth Circuit, and they uphold the lower court. The city now appeals and again asks the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court takes this case on, and as a result of its review of this case, upholds the decision by the Oregon City municipal leaders to enforce these ordinances and finds that there is no violation in enforcing these ordinances in addressing the homeless challenges there in Grants Pass. Now, likely to have broad implications, as we well imagine, throughout states in our nation. No violation of the Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. That, again written by Justice Neil Gorsuch. We have a dissent as we do. This one, again, right down ideological lines. in a dissent written by Sonia Sotomayor, joined by Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson. She says that the decision would leave society's most vulnerable with fewer protections. This is exactly what she says. She adds that the laws, which impose fines and potential jail time for people sleeping anywhere in public at any time, including in their cars, if they use as little as a blanket to keep warm or a rolled-up shirt as a pillow, that all of that punished people for being homeless. She said that is unconscionable, and she said it's unconstitutional. She read her dissent from the bench, which, again, as we indicated before, fairly rare. It signals her profound disagreement, presumably that of the other justices who likewise are opposed to what the Supreme Court has done in this particular case. In California alone, we know that there are about 170,000 people who are homeless. Nearly one-third of the country's population homeless. There are 40,000 people, more of those, who are homeless in the state than they were even 6 years ago. All of that in California. Tents and encampments are common in many parts of the state of California. Now, this is Oregon. It's not California, but it underscores the focus on the importance of this particular case in the remedies that local authorities, local officials can, and I would offer, obliged to do in addressing the problem of homelessness in America. The dissent in this case signals its strong disagreement with the notion that local officials can, in fact, simply implement and enforce ordinances that move the homeless populations off to other places. Sonia Sotomayor also indicating in the course of her statements about this that living and breathing and doing the other things is basically a part of life. And she says that when these kinds of ordinances are enforced as they are, you're not only violating the Constitution, but you're addressing and undermining basic human rights. That also a part of the dispute that continues even beyond what is happening here in this case called City of Grants Pass versus Johnson. And again, all of this a part of the Supreme Court's wrestling with issues that are significant to the matters in front of our nation. Chief Justice John Roberts appeared to encapsulate the views of at least his side of the perspective on this, suggesting the matter was an issue at best resolved by lawmakers and cities and states themselves. He says this. He says, why would you think that these nine people are the best to judge and weigh those policy judgments? He is talking there about the United States Supreme Court. These nine people, why would you think that we're the best able to judge and weigh those policy judgments? An interesting question to raise, maybe rhetorically, maybe beyond that, as Chief Justice Roberts and the other members of our Supreme Court, as I've indicated at the start of our two broadcast session this weekend, plainly involved in policy weighing and judgment determination in many, many other areas, important once again to our lives and our livelihoods here in the United States of America. All of this to indicate that our review of the Supreme Court, although concluded this weekend, continues next weekend. Why? Because we're going to be doing two things next weekend. We're going to be reviewing what the Supreme Court does tomorrow, Monday morning. Tune in for that. Immunity is on the docket, and social media is again on the docket. Two major decisions, actually three different cases, but two major decisions being issued by the Supreme Court. We're going to be talking about those. Here's the program note. Next weekend, as Amicus returns, and we are also going to be taking your questions, your inquiries, your comments about any of the commentary, any of the reporting that we have done here on Amicus in these two broadcast sessions of this weekend. I thank you for joining me. I thank you for joining Max and all of us concerned and focused on the issues being resolved by our United States Supreme Court at this time in our nation's history. Continue to monitor, continue to be focused, and continue to discuss the important role of the United States Supreme Court in the world and the nation of America in 2024. Have a good week, everyone. We will listen to you.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Representative Mark Pocan joins us to talk about National Postal Workers Day, and we'll hear from Dean Muller with Wisconsin for Environmental Justice. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones. Check 511WI.gov or download the app for road work or closures on your route. Know before you go with 511 Wisconsin, sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
Fabulous Farm Bay Pam Yonke here with the Midwest Farm Report live weekday mornings right here on WGBW. It's about your food and where it comes from. Tune in and learn. 5 a.m., 1590 a.m., 97.9 FM, the talk of Green Bay.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.